Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
This podcast is a production of KCRW and KCRW.com Santa Monica. If you enjoy this program, check out KCRW.com for more than 20 additional programs that you can podcast.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Matt Holzman, sitting in for proud new papa Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, but prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
To understand the current writer's strike, you need to understand the long and contentious relationship between screenwriters and the people who write the checks. This week on The Business, we'll put that relationship on the therapist's couch with Oscar-winning scribe Mark Norman. He's written a new book called What Happens Next? A History of American Screenwriting. Stick around. It's The Business from NPR. On the face of it, the current writer's strike is about writers wanting a bigger piece of the what happens next pie. Right now, they're mostly talking about money from internet streaming and downloads, but who knows what it'll be in the near future. The studios, for their part, are pleading poverty. And shocking as that claim seems, it may have some truth to it. The studios have made such outrageous profit participation deals with producers, actors, and directors that they're seeing smaller returns even as movie grosses go up. Of course, with Hollywood's fuzzy accounting practices, it's hard to know who's really making what, which makes having a meaningful conversation between the parties that much more difficult. The other impediment to a civil conversation about money is the long and not always happy relationship between Hollywood writers and the people who write their checks. The animosity and misunderstanding started way back, before the internet, even before TV, in the infancy of the movie business. To really understand the current strike, we're going to look at that dysfunctional history today with Oscar-winning screenwriter Mark Norman. He's written a new book called What Happens Next? A History of American Screenwriting. The title, of course, alludes to both the central question writers must answer in their work, but also brings up the uncertain future of the screenwriting trade in the ever-evolving business of show. Before we begin our conversation, we have to disclose that Mark Norman is on the WGA's negotiating committee, so we've stayed away from details of the current situation. We'd also like to point out that he began writing his book, which is obviously sympathetic to screenwriters, but certainly not blind to their foibles, years before there was talk of a strike. Mark, welcome to The Business.
Thank you.
Most of the issues that we're dealing with today, so we're talking about credit, we're talking about ownership, we're talking about pay, were issues that came up in the very beginning days of Hollywood.
My sense is that it was a marriage that got off on the wrong foot, and it has remained a bickering marriage, and the parties, for some reason, can't get divorced. Writers, especially when sound came in the mid-20s, the studios had to import people who know how to write dialogue. Nobody in town who was an established screenwriter knew that. They knew how to write title cards, but they didn't know how to write dialogue, and what's behind dialogue, the impulse that the characters have to say those things. And so they imported people who could write dialogue, which were mainly East Coast fiction writers, playwrights, novelists, short story writers. And yes, they did see the work as slumming. You have to keep in mind that movies, in terms of the national culture, didn't occupy the place they do now, movies and now television, meaning the central popular entertainment form. Movies, even into the 20s, were kind of working class, was kind of working class entertainment. It's kind of like roller derby or wrestling. And yeah, you could make a fortune coming out here in the 20s and writing movies, but all the writers, or many of the writers, professed that they were coming out here to bank some money away so they could go back and write the great novel or great play that was inside them. Few of them ever did.
Well, let's go back a little, though. I was shocked to find out that D.W. Griffith created Birth of a Nation without a script at all.
Well, scripts in those days, if you look at them, the physical scripts, were kind of like a couple-page outlines that basically listed the scenes and two or three words describing what was in the scene, and that was all the director needed. The directors and the actors kind of figured it out from there.
And we're talking the 10s and the 20s here.
Yes, and, you know, even into the 30s, some people were still making movies that way, kind of on the back of an envelope. Thomas Ince in 1913 was really the first guy to institutionalize screenplays as the blueprint for a movie, that all the departments would read a screenplay and therefore know what they were doing that day.
And in fact, that was a business decision. He actually created the first studio, as it were, where the wardrobe people and the camera people and the commissary and everything were in the same place. And that was in, where was that again?
It was, you know where the Getty is on the coast in Malibu?
Right.
If you go up the road that comes down to PCH from the Getty, it was back in there. It was back in those, kind of in the valley.
And they called that Inceville.
They called it Inceville.
There were writers. There were title writers.
First title cards were kind of stock footage that an editor could put in any place he wanted, like Came the Dawn or The Next Day or something like, or Later On or something like that. And then as stories started to get more sophisticated, they needed titles and brought in title writers. And title writers and screenwriters were kind of the same person, although title writers became kind of a specialty at the high water point of silence in the 20s. There were people who were making really good money just writing titles.
Now, what's interesting is that in these early days of making movies up until about the mid-20s, everything was being freely adapted. If there was a book, if there was a magazine story, if there was a play, Hollywood was just taking it and they were making a movie of it.
Pretty much until the teens. Movies were sort of outside the law, at least copyright law for the first 10 or 15 years of its existence.
It was a new technology.
And there was no law to cover it. There's no case law to cover it in terms of copyright. And so, yeah, people rated Ben-Hur, rated Tom Sawyer. You could take kind of anything and make a movie out of it. And the assumption was that the author or the author's estate who could sue you probably didn't see the movie.
Because it was low class.
Yeah, probably wouldn't go to see the movie and wouldn't be aware of it and so wouldn't sue you. And it wasn't until people actually started going to movies that they noticed that people were ripping off their clients. There was a lawsuit in, I think, 1908 that stretched on to 1913, where basically somebody had made a Ben-Hur, and Ben-Hur, General Lew Wallace's estate, he was the author, sued them and won. And the company had to pay damages, and that established movies as a copyrightable concept.
It kind of also codified the fact that book writers, playwrights, owned their stories, whereas those people who adapted them to some degree, and this is an inference, this is not what the law said, but by inference, that those people who were adapting them didn't really own them.
That's right.
Like a journalist who is hired by a newspaper
exactly.
to write a story.
Exactly. Screenwriters are hired on a sort of a journalistic concept. And as a matter of fact, a lot of the early screenwriters were journalists and so had no problem with a work for hire concept where basically you did some writing and you were given a check and the editor could either change it or even spike it, even just dump it. And as long as you got your check, that was okay. The writers who started coming into town in the 20s and 30s had a different experience because they'd been involved with New York Publishing, where they had a lot more say and a lot more clout, and they wanted it for their screen work too.
But it was interesting that and I think to some degree this continues today, that no matter who wrote it, the studio was the quote-unquote author of the script.
Well, the studio system that came out of people like Thalberg in the 20s was basically a way of controlling costs. And one of the costs they wanted to control was writing costs. And so the contracts they do had phrases like, this is a work for hire, meaning the writer who wrote the screenplay, either adapting some other work or even an original screenplay that came out of his or her own head, legally really did not belong to them. And legally, if you really looked at the legal definition, they weren't even the author. The studio was the author. The studio acquired all the rights that an author would have, rights for reprint, rights for distribution. Any right that an author would have in the book publishing business, the studio held. And this was contract law.
Studios
and
had
still is, let me add.
Is that right?
Yes. That contract, I mean, I signed that contract last year. It's still a case where writers have no ownership. Writers have tried to get ownership through a kind of royalty system over the years, and it's never worked. It's never flown.
At the time, when we're talking the 20s and the 30s, the studios had pools of writers, literally maybe even hundreds of writers.
Hundreds, if you look at Metro, a couple hundred maybe, on the lot, punching in a time clock every day, going to an office, and waiting to be assigned work, yeah.
It's like a secretarial pool.
Pretty much, and they were seen by their bosses often as replaceable. If you put one writer on a task and it didn't work, you pick somebody else off your list. You didn't necessarily feel compelled to work with that author and work through a creative process of getting what you want. You would kind of knock that writer off out of the seat and put another writer in the seat. And movies in the 20s and 30s often had 10 writers on them. They wouldn't all get credit, but 10 writers was not an extraordinary number of writers to put on a movie.
Now, the idea of 5 writers worked on this movie, like, that's so shocking. And yet at the time, that was 5 writers wouldn't be very many.
5 writers wouldn't. And Preston Sturges, there's a quote in the book that says he's looking at the system and he says 5 writers was usually an ideal number plus a woman writer for the girl parts. And that was the way the system worked.
I'm Matt Holzman, sitting in for Claude Brodesser-Ackner. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Oscar-winning screenwriter Mark Norman. His new book is What Happens Next, A History of American Screenwriting. We're trying to put a context on the current strike, looking at the history of the relationship between screenwriters and the people who write their checks. In the metro pool of 100 writers, to go back a little bit, there were big-name writers in that pool, right?
Yes. There was Dorothy Parker. There was Robert Benchley. There were, sure, big names from the East Coast, Ben Hecht, people who came out and basically turned their skills to screenwriting. And like I said, a lot of them said, oh, I'm just here for a week, I'm just here for a year, I'm just here till I get enough money in the bank account. And most of them never left.
And why would such huge figures and letters subject themselves to the situation?
Well, you have to examine the phrase huge figures and letters. Some of them were a little huger in their mind than they actually were in terms of their talents. You know, some literary luminaries came to Hollywood and tried to write screenplays. And
Faulkner.
I'm thinking of Fitzgerald, and I'm thinking of Faulkner,
right.
And didn't do well at all. And I think those people couldn't figure out that negotiation. They couldn't figure out where to draw the line between themselves and the needs of the industry.
And let's be honest, those people who did figure out this negotiation did so looking at a check that was gigantic, really. When you think of some of the figures that people were being paid then.
Not only was it was gigantic in the Depression.
Yes, right.
Let's keep that in mind. It was gigantic in a period where a lot of people's paycheck was 0.00.
Right.
And it was hard for a lot of them to turn their back on that.
So let's talk about the Depression. You write in the book, as the 1930s progressed, screenwriters were forced, like it or not, to find out who they were. What did you mean by that?
Well, I meant politically. You know, the 30s was a time of great political ferment. Politics seemed to be, for a lot of people in this country, a way to solve the problems of the Depression.
In this case, politics manifested itself in many ways as unionism.
It manifested as unionism, and it manifested as the writers' attempt to get some kind of sense of control.
Control.
The
right.
One thing that writers always lacked and I think have always wanted is some sense of control over their product. And not only did they have the studio system I was talking about earlier, but they had a sort of capitalist system that it was abusing them. It was kind of a political crescendo that finally drove the writers into forming a union. They tried before. There had never been the energy. Finally, the energy came in the mid-30s.
And part of that energy, it seems like, came from the fact that the studios pleaded poverty and made many of them cut their pay. And can you tell a story? There's a story of one of the studio chiefs pleading.
Well, I was Louis B. Mayer. I mean, and this is Samuel Marks, who was a story editor at Metro, tells the story about how he walked into a room where Louis B. Mayer had gathered all his contract players, all the writers, all the actors, all the directors, so hundreds of people in a room, and practically broke down in tears, saying, you know, the banks have folded, we're not making any money, we have to accept a pay cut. And people stood up in the audience and said, Louis B. Mayer, we're with you. Some old actress stood up and said, as the oldest member in the room, I accept the pay cut. And some child actor stood up and said, as the youngest in the room, I accept the pay cut. And everybody applauded and felt solidarity. And as Louis B. Mayer walked out of the room, he turned to one of his lieutenants and kind of winked and said, how did I do? You know, Louis B. Mayer didn't take any pay cut. The producers didn't take any pay cut. And the writers and the other contract players pretty soon figured out they'd been sold out.
Now, in corollary with that, Franklin Roosevelt created the National Industrial Recovery Act in June of 1933, which was encouraging collective bargaining.
That's right.
So they had both the motivation and the kind of the method.
Unfortunately, there was an interesting point in this. In order to get the government help, the writers had to accept the government definition of what an employee was. And the definition was an employee is somebody who produces a product who has no control over the distribution of that product. So the writers had to accept that language in their contract, and that's pretty much stayed ever since. Mm. Writers are still defined as employees who have no control over their product.
So they gained a lot at that time, but it seems they gave away
a very
key...
They gained a union, and they gave away their chance to be independent consultants, to basically have a right to profits, to have a right to a piece of the action.
Hmm. Now, what year was the first original story from start to finish that didn't really come from another source?
That's an interesting question, because original screenplays dreamt up by a writer and written kind of on his own time were really looked down on during the studio system. They were really a sign of either a writer who couldn't get a job and was trying to kind of create a calling card for himself, or a writer kind of past his prime who was trying to still stay in the game. The studios wanted product that had been successful in some other arena, on the stage, in the bookstores. That gave them a comfort level to adapt that as a movie.
And Preston Sturges was one of those people who actually did that. He wrote a spec script. And what happened there?
Well, he started to write a screenplay, and he ran into the story editor of some producer at a party and mentioned that, and the guy said, well, you ought to come see my boss and tell him about it. And he went in and described the story, and the boss said, well, that's interesting, you know, write up a 10-page treatment. And Sturges said, well, I'm already half through the screenplay. Why don't I just finish it and sell it to you? And the producer said, well, that's not the way we do business.
He wasn't
Sturges. He wasn't the Preston Sturges.
Okay, right.
And he went back and finished the screenplay and gave it to the producer. And the producer was amazed that a screenwriter on his own, without 10 screenwriters helping him and without studio notes, could write a successful screenplay. And he went through it with his staff and tried to find something wrong with it. And they couldn't. They couldn't find anything wrong. And he said to Sturges, I want to buy it. And Sturges said, well, you know, there's really no kind of there's no precedent for me selling you an original screenplay. Why don't we work out a deal where I get a percentage? And the producer made the deal. The producer was excoriated by Hollywood. There were editorials in the trade paper saying, how can you do this? This is going to destroy the business to cut writers in on profits. Now, even writers were upset. The notion that one writer would work on a screenplay and not 10, I mean, it was taking 9 jobs away. And the movie came out. The movie Power and the Glory was very well made and died.
It was a depressing movie during the Depression.
Yeah, and nobody particularly wanted to see it. And Sturges was thrown back on being a contract screenwriter for another 5 years, doing essentially what the studios wanted him to do. And the notion of writers having profit participation kind of sank into the sand and disappeared.
But nevertheless, the idea that that a screenwriter could get a percentage was planted for the future.
It was planted for the future, and it's always been dangling out there as kind of the screenwriter's El Dorado. And if you want to stop a negotiation at a 3-year Writers Guild contract real fast, bring up profit participation.
Right.
Bring it up, because it's a wet blanket. It's a killer.
After a short break, we'll have more with Oscar-winning screenwriter Mark Norman. His new book is What Happens Next, A History of American Screenwriting. We're trying to put a context on the current strike, looking at the history of the relationship between screenwriters and the people who write their checks. Stick around. It's The Business from NPR. You're listening to The Business, and I'm Matt Holzman, sitting in for Claude Brodesser-Ackner, who's out on paternity leave. In screenwriter Mark Norman's new book, What Happens Next? A History of American Screenwriting, he beautifully describes how the Hollywood moguls of yesteryear saw screenwriters and their work.
None of them were quite sure what a screenwriter did or even how he did it. Certainly, he or she delivered an artifact, a screenplay, that worked or didn't. But where did it come from? The writer's typewriter delivered by a rocket ship from Pluto, or, even more terrible to contemplate, stolen from somebody else who owned the rights? Did it take them a year to write a screenplay, or only one day, and then they waited a year to hand it in? There was no telling because nobody could see the work occur. The screenwriter functioned in private, secluded, unwatchable, and so took on the uneasy taboo that surrounded all those who go off into forests or jungles to have some solipsistic experience. They weren't social, weren't good company, they didn't drink or f*** enough for the most part, they tended to be quiet, defensive, touchy. Because they'd seen the movie before anyone else, in the perfect theater of their brain, they tended to be possessive, individualistic, trying to control what everybody else on the picture did, but without the authority. They didn't have to deal with the Catholics, evangelists, ladies' church groups, and their mail campaigns. They were like football kickers, specialists. They didn't pitch in, didn't get tackled. They weren't part of the movie company, the gang that went on the floor and bashed the damn thing out. They finished their work before the company gathered and were gone when it began. How could anybody quantify what they were worth, put a fee against their labors? Perhaps any social system needs an other, negative to its positive, the counterpoint it needs to define itself. Screenwriters gradually became the other of the movie business. Schmucks with Underwoods, Jack Warner called them, and he was snarling.
Writers, for their part, were not helping their cause. Most, quote-unquote, serious writers were from back east, and they felt that films, that much-maligned fledgling form of entertainment, was beneath them. Here's a quote from Mark Norman's book attributed to 30s and 40s New York newspaper man-turned-screenwriter Sam Hoffenstein.
The movies. They tear you away from your home, draw you into a pigsty of people, make you do stuff that disgusts you, rip out all your ambition of inventiveness, reduce you to a hack, and what do you get out of it? A fortune! All that remained was the fortune. As Dorothy Parker told a reporter, quote, "I want nothing from Hollywood but money, and anyone who tells you that he came here for anything else or tries to make beautiful words out of it lies in his teeth."
The dynamic between suspicious producers and recalcitrant writers set in motion the long and contentious relationship between screenwriters and the people who write their checks. Today we're talking about the history of that relationship. We pick up the conversation with Mark Norman just before World War II.
After, I think, 6 or 7 or 8 years of struggling, the studios finally agreed to let the Writers Guild be a negotiating partner. And that was in 1941, and it was basically because the studios had exhausted their legal attempts to block it, and because there was a war beginning, and it just looked bad for the studios to invite a strike by the writers at the point that, a few months after Pearl Harbor. And writers kind of came in through the back door and kicking and screaming, getting a union.
What things had they negotiated for?
Minimum wages, writers determining their own credits. In other words, writers having the right to arbitrate credits and being essentially in charge of assigning credits instead of leaving that up to the studios. The assigning of credits in the 20s and into the 30s was totally corrupt. It was whoever the studio wanted to give credit to. They could give it to the writer who actually wrote it. They could give it to another writer who needed, quote-unquote, a credit for his career. They could give it to somebody's cousin. They could give it to a masseuse. There was no restriction, and masseuses got credit sometimes.
Well, maybe they deserved it, but that's all another discussion. So minimum wage, they could determine credits.
Writers, no speculative writing, meaning a studio could not say to a writer, well, write something for us and then we'll decide if we want to pay you or not. Studios had to make contracts with writers up front. Studios had to pay for writers' transportation and housing when they went on location. That's what comes to mind as the major stipulations.
And these all happened before the war, right before the war started,
right.
Or as the war was starting.
Late 1941.
All right, so now another interesting part of the war was that movies became part of the war effort.
Well, movies had just simply gotten better during the 30s, and people began to be aware of this, and some of the smart people in Washington saw that movies, if folded into the war effort, could be part of the war effort. And Washington was hip enough to the potential of movies to essentially want Hollywood to cooperate and make positive movies to help the war efforts. And screenwriters suddenly found themselves wanted.
They got some respect.
Yes, suddenly respect. And it was respect coming over the heads of their employers. It was coming from Washington. Right. And screenwriters felt optimistic about that.
So after the war, there is a very big change. You start getting an influx of writers to Hollywood who grew up on movies and want to be screenwriters. They're not people who had to dumb down their ideals or wanted to write the great American novel, who decided they were going to write movies because they had no choice or they wanted the money. These were people who wanted to write movies.
That's right. And interestingly enough, that shift, it's almost 60 years old, has never really been acknowledged by the business. The stereotype still applies that writers are these kind of aesthetes in their bathrobes who look down on the work they do. But in fact, most writers I know in television and in movies are in the business because they really love the business. They love the medium. They love writing for it. And they see themselves very much as partners of their employers rather than employees.
Right.
And that's one of the disjuncts.
Let's talk a little about the blacklist. And one of the things that surprised me is that the studios, in a way, I'm not going to use the word encouraged, but there were benefits to them of the blacklist.
It helped keep the union in check. It smacked down the writers, those wise guys who kept on asking for this and asking for that and sneaking little double entendres into their screenplays.
And they could hire people without having to pay all the stuff that they had negotiated
they didn't
for
have
pay
to,
them under
exactly,
the table.
They didn't have to pay them as much. I think the studios were always ambivalent about it. I think they were afraid. I think what you had is the great generation of moguls getting old and getting afraid of what the government could do and kind of knuckling under in the hopes that the government would leave them alone. Hollywood has never wanted is anybody from the government looking closely at it.
So let's jump ahead a bit to the 50s. So now we're talking about freelance writers. You have a statistic in the book. In 1945, there were 470 writers on contract. By 1960, there were only 42. We're talking about in the early days of Metro, where maybe having 10 writers on a movie, no one can afford that.
Right.
And we're talking about the first appearance of what we now call the quote, where the heat on a writer might help determine his pay.
Right.
And one of the major differences, you know, one of the things that we hear these days is about the fact that a writer has to be good in the room.
That's right. You know, in the 30s, under the studio system, writers were basically hired by something, a sample of something they had written, and it probably was some other kinds of fiction. It was a play or a short story or something. And they were thrown in a room and basically given a job. And if what they produced worked, they were kept on. And if it didn't, they were fired. But they didn't have to sell themselves in a room. Really, with freelancing, a writer not only had to be able to produce the work, but had to get the job. And that required pitching or being pitched to, and did require interpersonal skills that writers hadn't needed before then.
The auteur theory of filmmaking in the 60s would be a boon to the creative process, but a bit of a kick in the head to screenwriters. We'll continue our conversation there next week with Oscar-winning writer Mark Norman. His new book is What Happens Next? A History of American Screenwriting. And that's The Business. I'm Matt Holzman, sitting in for Claude Brodesser-Ackner, who's just had a bouncing baby boy. I produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Matt Holzman, and we'll see you next week on The Business.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.